It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. As we begin the program, just want to remind you, please check out their services. Go to online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And don't hesitate to give their office a call, a 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
So, the topic for the day.
Okay, Lockwood. Actually, Wes, I'm going to throw you a curveball. You go ahead and introduce us, and then I'll kind of take it over from there.
Okay, sounds good. Lockwood, we're going to talk a little bit about elder abuse and how to avoid elder abuse. Basically, how do you protect family members? How do you protect mom? How do you protect dad? Grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles, so on and so forth. In this world in which we as attorneys certainly see elderly folks being targeted both on the internet and via telephone and even in person. And what steps can you take legally and just basically slash common sense and legally to protect them from losing their assets? Because obviously the intent of those trying to take advantage of folks who are elderly is to extract money from them. So that's the topic.
You know, let me just opine on this real very quickly. That's something that the vast majority of family members don't think about, and that is we're not, shall we say, we're not paranoid. We're not looking for evildoers or anybody trying to do criminal acts. But it is interesting. It's not something that we would normally think about. We're thinking about taking care of our family members. That's the first and foremost on our plate, if you will. So you're going to, I gather, share with us some protective measures just to put in place just so that then we don't have to think about those things. Am I thinking correctly?
Yes. And Lockwood, this abuse, if you will, or inappropriateness can come at our clients from all sorts of directions. Mm-hmm. Of course, as Wes mentioned, there is now the fraud and internet and phone calls and those kinds of things. But many, many times it actually, unfortunately, I must say, you know, can be someone in the family, or a caregiver or a neighbor or what isn't a friend but might be referred to as a friend. it's so very easy to defraud an elder person. They are by nature, and we're all going to get there someday. You know, they are insecure and infirm many times. They are in need of care and support and love and affection and all of these things, and so they are vulnerable. And someone who is vulnerable can then make mistakes. Now, Lockwood, all of this is going to begin with that infamous document that Wes and I speak of all the time, which is the durable power of attorney. And this is the document where our elder person would appoint someone to take care of their financial affairs. The word durable just is very simple. It just means that it's during the duration of their incapacity or their inability to act for themselves. The document continues to be in force and effect or durable during that time period. But we all need this document. And of course, if we have a power of attorney, that begins to set the framework for the agent, who is many times a son, daughter, grandchild, whatever the case might be, niece, nephew, to come in and tell us that, look, I'm so concerned that my loved one has lost money through fraud on the internet or telephone scams or mail or I'm concerned that the caregiver is not on the up and up, or I'm concerned that my brother or my sister. So again, Lockwood, we're going to hear these facts with any kind of variation on theme, okay? But the power of attorney is where it all starts. Now, in the power of attorney, there is a provision whereby the agent, the person that is appointed, is given the authority to create a trust, irrevocable or revocable, to modify or to amend any existing trust. This is a specific grant of authority in a well-drafted power of attorney. And this is sometimes in our office when Wes and I are seeing powers of attorney, we become, not happy right out of the gate because it doesn't have that authority in it. It's some sort of short form with initials or, a 2 or 3 page document. It doesn't have the detail that we want to see. We need a very specific paragraph that allows this agent under the power of attorney to create, modify, amend existing trust. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once that provision is affirmed and we know that it's there, then the next step would be to potentially create a trust. We call it in our office sometimes a management trust, whereby the assets of the principal, the loved one, if you will, are transferred into this trust. Now, this is kind of a title issue, Lockwood. First of all, the trust right out of the gate would word that all of the assets in the trust are there for the dad, the mom, the granddad, the principal, the mother, the father, whoever it happens to be. But guess what? When Wes and I go and instruct the client to retitle the asset in the name of the trust, which then is under the control of the trustee, then bingo, we've protected those assets from any kind of fraudulent activity. The signature that is now needed on the account, be it at the stock company or the bank account, or the CD, whatever, the annuity, whatever asset it happens to be, those assets would require the signature of the trustee. And the trustee, of course, right out of the gate is going to say, well, who are you? Mm-hmm. Why are you wanting this $10,000 from my dad? Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to do that, okay? I need to have more information.
Right.
And so this is a very good tool in our toolbox that we can use for clients. And we run into a little wrinkle. I'll let Wes go here. We run into a little wrinkle, though, Lockwood, when the asset is a retirement account. Retirement accounts are IRAs, 401ks, things of that nature, where the tax on those accounts has been deferred. They, by their nature, have to stay in the name of the principal, granddad, mom, dad, whoever it is. And we can't just transfer a retirement account, if you will, IRA is what I'm referring to, or 401k, something like that, into the trust, because if we do that, retitle it in the name of the trust, we would recapture the income, the deferred income, and that could be a real problem. So Wes and I have had many files like this, and Wes, and there's no perfect solution to this, but let me let Wes kind of tell you what we sometimes do.
Well, what we do, Lockwood, is, kind of to wrap this trust issue up into a nice bow and package here, is that we want to transfer everything that we can transfer over using the power of attorney into the trust for the benefit of mom or dad or whomever's funds that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to look at real estate. We're going to look at accounts that are not tax deferred accounts. So we're going to accomplish everything that we can without causing any unnecessary tax.
Right. Right.
And so we clean up that part of it so we can avoid the possibility of someone nefariously stealing those funds or getting mom or dad to sign a document that transfers those funds, or tricking mom or dad to from writing a check, you know, for and sending it to, you know, Africa or somewhere like we've seen before in our office. We've got some control with regard to that. But then, like Cecil said, we get to the point of cleaning up everything we can and protecting everything we can. But most folks do have, you know, some level of asset held in a retirement account of some sort, like Cecil said, an IRA or 401k, a 403b, you know, some type of deferred tax retirement account. And so, you know, we could transfer those over, but like Cecil indicated, you know, that would trigger a pretty significant tax event, which, you know, we want to avoid that. So the way we normally deal with that is not through the structure of the title of those assets, but we find that the cleanest way to deal with that issue is to attempt to develop a relationship and even put checks and balances in place with regard to whoever the broker is who's dealing with that particular account. So, you know, we can have an agreement entered even that if there's any activity in the retirement accounts other than the mandatory distributions, then before any such activity is taken, there has to be communications with, you know, the agent, the child, so on and so forth. And so, you know, most folks, it would be an unusual situation for a large amount of funds to be taken out of a retirement account anyway. Because if, you know, if you're exceeding the mandatory distributions, then, you know, that's going to trigger a tax event anyway. So putting that in place, and in some managers or you know, brokerage places like Edward Jones or, you know, even Fidelity or whatever they may be, you know, you can have documentation in place between the agent and that company so that there are some checks and balances. And so we find that that's the cleanest way to deal with that. We find that that is, that works. And, you know, when the fraudsters realize that things are set up like this and there's some legal intervention going on, then normally they disappear. Because they want to go after the low hanging fruit. You know, not those folks who have been smart and have gotten their things set up properly and have protected against actions from folks like those. So there's not really a particular legal mechanism with regard to these tax deferred accounts that won't trigger a tax event that we want to avoid. But there is a framework that we can help clients put in place so that we can, you know, protect from that possibility of even those tax deferred accounts being subject to fraudulent activity.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins here this afternoon on Let's Talk Legal. You know, the issue, back to the topic of elder abuse and pensions, or retirement accounts. The one thing I was wondering is pensions. Pensions are, of course, fading. There aren't that many pensions nowadays being developed. But in the establishment of a pension, is there a way to work with the pension organization, usually major corporations, to accommodate that kind of communications, Cecil, Wes?
Well, the pension, that's a good question, Lockwood. The pension, though, usually is paid out, you know, almost on a monthly basis.
Right.
Didn't have to be. Sometimes other kinds, quarterly or whatever, usually monthly, like Social Security, and it's directly deposited into the elder person's bank account. So when we retitle the bank account in the name of the management trust, then bingo, we now have that covered.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, circulating around all of this is that if matters become, maybe there isn't a power of attorney, maybe the elder person never signed a power of attorney and is now incompetent to do so, or maybe they just simply will not cooperate in signing a power of attorney. Sometimes we even see files where they're isn't really anyone available to be the power of attorney, to be the agent. So circulating around all of these elder law issues this this afternoon, Lockwood, is that other word that Wes and I talk about so often, which is guardianship. And ultimately, if we are forced into a proceeding before the clerk of court, whereby the elder person is found to be danger to themselves, their personhood, not taking their medications, doing things that are putting their health greatly at risk and or their assets at great risk, then we would receive a guardianship order. That, of course, then will lock down the accounts, much like the management trust does. And so That comes with added expense and delay and accountings every year and bond filings and things of that nature. So it's not the first place that we go in our advice to clients. We try to go through other avenues of meeting the client's objective and goals other than the guardianship, but it does happen. And then Wes texted me this morning a very good point that I don't want us to run out of time.
We've got plenty of time.
Okay, just doesn't get talked about enough. And that's adult protective services. I would like for Wes and I to spend some time talking about that. I don't know that we really have spoken about that in the past much. Adult Protective Services is a department, division, if you will, of the Department of Social Services. And it is a very wonderful and well-staffed group of people. And it is county by county. Each county has its Department of Social Services, Carteret, Craven, Onslow, Jones County. And as such, there are folks that are assigned to that particular department, Department of Social Services, Adult Protective Services. And what our clients have to hear and our listeners is that many times there will be a report or a complaint made to Adult Protective Services about an elder person, about their potentially being elder abuse. Sometimes it's physical, unfortunately, but there are many times it's financial, and they will then do an investigation, and they're thorough with these investigations, and they will sometimes want to have the banking records, and they will spend a lot of quality time getting to the bottom of whether or not this complaint has veracity to it, and so. What I want our listeners to understand is just we need to know that that's out there, okay?
Right.
And that if for some reason things are not in order with your elder person, either, and again, sometimes it can even be medically, it can be a physical. I have clients who say to me, oh, no, I'm not going to put mother in a nursing home. That's not going to happen. I'm not going to put her in a skilled care facility. Well, sometimes it's not completely up to we, the family. If the medical team determines that the elder person must have 24-hour care, and if they're at risk, their health is at risk, If they do not have 24-hour care, then potentially, again, Adult Protective Services is going to become involved. So we enjoy working with Adult Protective Services. We work with them very regularly. We are there to help them and assist them in their investigation. They like working with us as well because we can give them the background on the client and things of that nature. But Adult Protective Services, I'm glad that Wes texted that to me this morning because, and now Wes, I'll let you talk about it, but that's a very important aspect of elder law, Adult Protective Services.
Wes?
Right. So Adult Protective Services will take a complaint, and it's my understanding when a complaint is made, it's kept private. It's anonymous, so you don't really stand in a position to be targeted or there being some kind of retribution as a result of you complaining about whatever the issue is. And if it's a plausible complaint, then and it looks as though there's potentially a need to protect an adult. I mean, this could be like a living situation. This could be a situation medically. It could be a situation with nutrition. It could be a situation with hygiene. You know, anything that jeopardizes the health and or well-being of the adult, then Adult Protective Services will investigate that, visit the residents, visit the location, do, you know, basically an interview and an investigation and make a determination as to whether it's something that is that has merit. And if there's merit there, then potentially APS, Adult Protective Services, will even proceed forward with a guardianship themselves to get someone in place to make decisions for the adult. So that is certainly a tool that can be used in, if there is evidence of or a concern that an adult is in jeopardy in some way. But let me tell you what Adult Protective Services is not designed to do. They're not designed to gather and collect assets and recover assets that have been lost.
Okay.
And so the first part of our program that we talked about this morning, the use of the power of attorney, the preparation of the appropriate trust, the transfer of assets into the trust for the benefit of mom or dad or whomever the principal is, the developing a relationship with and putting in place the proper safeguards with a broker who is managing any tax deferred funds, you know, that type of framework, setting that up is, you know, that's your ounce of prevention. So we don't have to try to cure the problem later on,
right?
Because Adult Protective Services won't go file a lawsuit for collection of money. And we don't ever want our clients to be in a position where we're having to file a lawsuit for collection of money, because in many cases, the money that has been transferred is long gone.
Right.
It's in, I mean, many cases, it's out of the United States. It's with someone who we don't even know who that someone is. And so it's a complete waste of time, you know, to file a lawsuit. Now, we've had cases before Lockwood where folks have attempted to defraud elderly individuals by having them sign deeds and purportedly transfer real property, even this local, you know, Carteret County, Craven County, real property. Well, that's a horse of a different color, because if the asset is here, it's real property. Obviously, it's not in out of the country. It's here. In many cases, we can set aside those deeds depending on the circumstances under which, you know, they were signed. So it's important for folks to recognize that APS, Adult Protective Services, is a resource. They can help. They can conduct an investigation. But as far as protecting assets go, it's important, I think, to put your have your framework in place if there is some concern of, you know, a elderly person, someone who can't really protect themselves that well or who is easily deceived, if there's evidence that they potentially are going to or subject to this influence and are going to lose their, you know, lose what they've accumulated during their lifetime.
Right.
So it's not, well, I can all, we can always just call APS if there's some kind of issue. We can all, you know, it could be this. I mean, it could be a situation where there's a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
And the caregiver, we believe, is taking advantage of the elderly person. And but the caregiver may be providing, you know, a healthy environment.
Right.
A clean house, nutrition,
mm-hmm.
transfer to medical. So from all appearances, the situation may look just fine. But, you know, we get into it a little further, we see that there's a transfer of, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, over to this caregiver. So the appearance there may be everything is fine, and that the adult may be able to, or the elderly adult may be able to make decisions for himself or herself, but, you know, they're being unduly influenced. So the first things we talked about in the program today, setting the trust up, doing those kind of things would avoid that type of situation. So kind of what I'm telling you is these situations where elderly folks are taken advantage of appear in all kind of situations, mm-hmm. all kind of permutations. They appear, they, you know, some of them is obvious, some of them is not so obvious until you start looking at bank records, until you start looking at checks that were written. You know, and then how do you get that information, Lockwood? Well, you can get it using a power of attorney.
Right.
So that's that takes us back to like the very first document that's very right. important is the power of attorney.
You know, I want to go to that for a moment, if I could. We've got Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. That was Wes Collins of me a moment ago. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And again, I want to remind you that number 252 area code 726-9050. You know, this is a topic that obviously we're kind of looking at two different groups. Obviously, the parents, grandparents, those that are looking at elderly age here soon, maybe the necessity to think about possibly creating a durable power of attorney and a trust. And then you've also got the children who should be in discussions, and I want to talk about that in a moment. But you mentioned a moment ago about guardianship, and you use the word bond. So I'm wondering, in the case of a guardianship order and the establishment of a guardianship because the principal is not of capacity, I hope I'm using that term correctly, is not of capacity, what is the process for the bonding? And, you know, what is the purpose of the bond? What is that, an insurance policy? What exactly is the bond in that case?
Yeah, the bond is just, it is statutory, it's required. If you're going to be guardian, general guardian or guardian of the estate, as opposed to just guardian of the person, then you have a responsibility for managing, looking over the assets, controlling the assets of the ward. The ward is the person who's been adjudicated incompetent. And so you have to provide accountings to the clerk of court as to how those assets are being used. You have to show that they're being used for the benefit of the principal. You have to sometimes seek court orders with regard to how the assets are being used, depending on the circumstances. So anyway, you're managing money. And so when you're in a fiduciary capacity as a guardian, and you're managing the money of someone else through a court order, which is in the this context of guardianship, then you have to put a bond in place, and the bond is an insurance product where a premium is paid, just like, you know, premiums being paid for car insurance or health insurance or life insurance, and then that bond is in place in the event that there is any type of loss of those assets based on certain type events, such as, you know, misuse of the funds or, you know, just, you know, misuse of the funds is probably the broadest, right, best way to say it. If you use, if you lose them because you do something to benefit yourself, or if, I mean, it could even be that it was an ill-advised investment or something like that,
mm-hmm,
and there's a loss, then there could be a claim on the bond, you know, to restore the asset that has been lost. So
where does the premium come from? Does the premium, is that paid by the guardian, or is that, does it come out of the assets of the guardianship?
Statute doesn't specifically say.
Oh.
In every guardianship that I can recall that we've ever dealt with, the premium has been paid from the assets of the ward.
Okay.
But we're talking about, in most cases, you know, hundreds of dollars.
Okay.
We're not talking about, you know, $50,000 or 20 or 10 or even 5, maybe even not $1,000, maybe even not $2,000. So it's not a large amount. It's basically the bond itself is set up by analyzing and the assets, mm-hmm, of the person who's making application for it, and that's the guardian.
Okay.
And, you know, if they have like a felony background, then you got a problem. Ooh. Right off the bat. You're not going to be able to be the guardian anyway.
Right.
If you've got some criminal issues in your background that aren't a felony, that might be a problem. If you have very limited assets, that might be a problem. So the company that's providing the bond wants to know that if they have to pay on this bond, that they can collect against the assets of the person making application for, mm-hmm, the bond.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So
I like the word Lockwood surety. Uh-huh. Sometimes folks will refer to this bond as a surety bond, S-U-R-E-T, surety, T-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that kind of means that, you know, we want to be assured.
Right.
The government, the state of North Carolina, the clerk of court wants to be assured that the guardian is not going to take the ward's money and go off to, you know, the Bahamas and never return. Okay. So this is some assurance, this bond, an assurance that won't happen. and so, you know, we run into these bond applications routinely at our office. We assist our clients in getting them, but we get them from commercial insurance companies.
Okay.
You know, the companies that we all know about, Travelers, State Farm, Farm Bureau, they all issue these insurance contracts or surety bonds, and they're very manageable, as Wes is saying. Yes.
All right. You know, this, as we wrap it up, one of the things I think that comes out of this is the necessity, and we've talked about this many times before, communications. It starts with a conversation, does it not?
Well, it does, and it starts with good documentation.
Uh-huh.
It is just critical that folks, as we all get older, obtain a well-drafted, very detailed, durable power of attorney. I don't know. I sometimes say that, and I probably shouldn't, but I sometimes say the durable power of attorney is the most powerful estate document, even more powerful than your last will and testament.
Wow.
And I don't really mean that.
But I know
But you know what I'm saying. I mean, the power of attorney is operating while we're living.
Right.
And our life, okay, is affected whether or not we do or do not have such a document. A last will and testament, of course, a lot of folks will make the comment, they say, well, you know, Mr. Cecil, I won't be here to worry about it. Now, you know, you'll have to worry about that with my children. Yeah. I'm not going to be here to worry about it.
Yeah.
But on the power of attorney side, you are going to be here to worry about it, okay? It's going to affect your life as you become older, and it is a document that Wes and I strongly advise.
I appreciate this. I think this is a worthwhile conversation, and I want to thank both of you. That is Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. we're talking about, well, elder abuse, but as Cecil just closed out, the durable power of attorney. Make that phone call, 252 area code 726-9050, and go online to harvellandcollins.com. Gentlemen, thank you for your time this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal.
Thank you,
Harper.